Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peake, and welcome to episode 128 of Her, the podcast all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her breasts. Yeah, you heard me right. This is going to be such a great podcast. Before we start, just know that this episode of Her is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Complete Vitamins. They're delicious once-a-day gummies that contain the complete vitamin, mineral, folate, and omega mix, customized just for women. Trust me, you won't forget to take them because they taste so great. To learn more, go to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And just a quick reminder to hop on over to iTunes after our episode and rate and review us because I read these and I love to hear from you. Your feedback is platinum. Love it, love it. All right. It's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Did you know that there's a book out there about your breasts, ladies? Uh-huh, there is. And the whole thing is just such a beautiful and unique take on the history of breasts. There's things there you just need to know. Bet you never knew, for that matter. We have with us Florence Williams, who is the author of The Nature Fix and is a journalist and contributing editor to Outside Magazine. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine, and National Geographic, among others. Her first book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, was a New York Times notable book of 2012 and the winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in Science and Technology. Oh yeah, we love this one. And her Apple podcast, launched by Gracie award-winning series Breasts Unbound on December 5th. Oh my gosh, we got to check this one out. 8 episodes. So let's just get right into it. Florence, welcome back on to the Her podcast.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pam. It's great to be here.
Okay, why a podcast about breasts? What was going on? I mean, seriously, it's such a great idea.
I had the same question, but I'm lucky because a producer read my book, loved it, and approached me and said, I think we could turn this into a podcast. And as a print journalist, you know, I had to sort of wrap my head around that and figure out how that could possibly work. But she had this great vision for the program. Her name is Mary Beth Kirshner. She's my producer and my partner. We took the idea to Audible, and they have a channel just for Audible original content. And they commissioned 8 episodes for it, and we're really excited about it. And I'm also happy to say that it just launched on Apple Podcasts last week.
Yay!
Yay!
So how can someone access that? What's the technical thing they have to do?
They can either find it through their Audible app and then go to the Audible Original Channels feature on that, or they can get it wherever they get podcasts, including now from Apple Podcasts. And it's called Breath.
Okay,
Unbound.
Awesome. Okay, and we're going to, I mean, I'm just going to give everyone a little teaser out there about this series, as it were. The episode 1 is 55 years of plastic implants. I don't even want to think about that. Knocking on evolution's door, busting the bust myth. We're going to talk about that in a second. What men can teach us about breast cancer. Uh-huh. Bugs and breast milk. Want to hear more about that? What's in Chelsea Handler's boobs? Oh, gosh, I don't even want to know. the new normal puberty, the future of breasts. Now, let's go to this whole place of the busting the bus myth. Why do we have so many misconceptions about breasts?
I think it's because we live in an age right now in, you know, modern America where we just believe that breasts are for sex. We believe that they're sexualized. We believe that there's, you know, this reality that men like big breasts, that all men like them, that they have to be big and they have to be sort of perky. and we see that breast everywhere, right? We see it in Hollywood. We see it in pornography. And this has been true ever since really the 1950s in the United States. The sort of big, perky breasts took primacy in popular culture. And I wanted to find out why. Like, was there a real anthropological reason for that? Is there something absolute about the way we view breasts? You know, that is there one kind of breast that's really a turn on, and every other kind of breast kind of is somehow substandard? Okay, so what the science actually says is that no, there actually is not a universally preferred breast type. And we know this because now there have been surveys of people across different cultures, across different times, showing that, in fact, some men actually prefer smaller breasts, some men prefer medium breasts, and yes, some men do prefer larger breasts. But check this out, Dr. Pam. There are even a lot of men out there who are leg men or who are ass men and who sort of, you know, could take or leave the breast. And so I feel like
and basically
really...
blow off the breasts and just sort of go to the other anatomical parts.
yeah, there you go. So it turns out that really this notion that we have of, you know, there being sort of one perfect kind of breast is really a total cultural artifact. It's just not really true.
How fascinating. And is that true in all cultures? You know, you looked at this issue of are breasts sexualized in all cultures. I mean, really, how universal is this, if it's true?
Yeah, it turns out it's not universal at all. So I think one of the reasons why it took such a kind of, you know, it became so large in our imagination in the United States was really for a couple of reasons. One is that Hollywood, you know, saw the dawn of movie stars like Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield.
Oh, yeah.
And this happened at about the same time that GIs and veterans were coming back from World War II. And this was a really interesting time. I talked to a film scholar about this, and she said, look, you know, women in the 1940s during the war, they had jobs in factories. They took over the men's jobs. They were starting to sort of threaten men's positions in factories and in the workplace. And when men came back from the war, they wanted those jobs back. And so there was this kind of deliberate push, in a way, to put women back in their place in the home, to sexualize them, to domesticize them, you know, to sort of heighten their role as mothers and girlfriends, just kind of take them out of the workplace. And so breasts actually became a tool for doing that. And so we sexualized their bodies even more than they already were. We made their breasts more prominent in popular culture. Playboy also came out about the same time. Marilyn Monroe was actually in the first issue of Playboy. And so women's bodies became kind of hypersexualized almost in reaction to their going into the workplace in World War II.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, that's the first time I have ever heard that. And but it makes all the sense in the world. It really does. I mean, there was like a convergence of a lot of these factors that basically strengthened your argument. I find that fascinating. You said that you interviewed this individual about what was going on during that time. You had some pretty amazing interviews for your podcast. What were some of your favorites?
For the episode we did on evolution, I had a really good time going to Oxford in England, and I interviewed Dr. Desmond Morris, who is very well known for being the author of a book called The Naked Ape. And this came out in the early 1960s. And in this book, he really looked at human beings as animals and sort of our animal instincts, kind of a lens to looking at our sexuality, looking at how our bodies may have evolved. And he has a whole chapter on breasts. And so I really wanted to go talk to him. He's now in his 80s. And I was curious to know if his views on breasts and breast evolution have changed. And it turns out they haven't. And I have to explain what his views are, because they're
yeah, what are his views?
Interesting. and his views actually had this tremendous influence for decades and still have a tremendous influence on the way evolution is taught in universities today. So he believed that when humans became bipedal, you know, we are apes, right? We used to walk on all fours, our early ancestors, but then we became bipedal. We started walking on 2 feet, 2 legs. And so he feels like we developed these large permanent orbs on our chest, our breasts, to really mimic the orbs on our bottom, because other apes transmit sexual signaling through their bottom, through their rumps. And so he felt like breasts evolved as this almost mimic of the buttocks in order to convey to men a sexual signal that we were available, that we were fertile, that we were young. And so for him, breasts are just this buttock mimic and exist purely as a means of conveying kind of this message to men that we are ready to mate. And so what's so provocative about that is that it really assumes that breasts are a sexual signal and, in fact, not something that evolved as a naturally selected trait. What's unique about the human breast is that it is permanently enlarged, whereas other mammals, other apes, only really have full round breasts while they're lactating. Otherwise, they have sort of flat chests. And so he was like, well, why do humans need to have these like full round breasts all the time? So he says it's because of a sexual signal. But I also talked to all these feminist anthropologists who, you know, came of age later in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, and they're like, whoa, wait a minute. We have to acknowledge that breasts really exist as lactation devices. They evolve to feed infants. And maybe we should look at how they work and why they work to sort of solve the question of why they evolved. Like, isn't it possible that they evolved somehow to increase the natural fitness of the woman herself and also of her infant? And that really men's interest in breasts, you know, is secondary at best. And so I think that's a really interesting debate, and I think it's hard to actually figure out who's right, but I do think it's worth asking the question.
How fascinating. You know, really getting back into the evolution and looking at, you know, answering that question, why? I mean, clearly lactation is a monster here. There's no question about it. And lactation wasn't just providing the fuel for the child, but actually protecting the child through boosting the immune system as the mother was able to introduce, microbes and other factors into the infant's body so that the infant could now develop its own little resistance and its ability to adapt and adjust as it evolved. So all of that we now understand is extremely powerful. So, you know, to that argument, that's a very, very strong piece of evidence. I think our Oxford friend here has a very colorful and interesting, you know, take on this, which, you know, I'm scratching my head and thinking about orbs and trying to figure out how that one really works.
Dr. Pam, I just want to tell you, too, another thing that I so enjoyed and cracked me up about visiting him was that I saw his studio in Oxford, and he's also an artist, not just, you know, a zoologist. And I walked into his studio, and the first thing you see are all his paintings and these sculptures that he's collected from all over the world, and they're all about breasts, right? They're breasts in his paintings.
Okay, someone has an issue. I'm just saying, someone has an issue.
he's obviously a boob guy. He is a boob guy. And
yeah,
I think, you know, this question really matters of why breasts evolved and who they evolved for, because the question, it really determines how we look at breasts. You know, are breasts for men? And if they are, maybe that justifies, you know, all this groping, you know, all this obsession that we see of men with breasts, the sort of bad behavior on display, the fact that fewer women are breastfeeding all the time. And partly that's because we have a cultural discomfort with breastfeeding. And partly that is because we tend to over-sexualize these breasts and we think, hey, breasts aren't really about babies, ladies, they're about men. So I think these are really important questions to ask.
Well, you know, it's like, who do they really belong to?
Exactly.
Right?
Who do they belong
and
to?
And why should they belong to anybody other than the person who's wearing them?
Exactly. And if we believe that actually these breasts are for women themselves and for their babies, because they increased our fitness when we were living, you know, in the Pleistocene, we needed places to store fat, and our breasts were very useful places to store fat. They actually helped us survive. Then we need to think about now, how can we really take back the breath? How can we own that conversation? How can we assert that breaths are really about ourselves and maybe get some men to start behaving a little better?
You think? Especially within the current context of what's going on. You know,
exactly.
Speaking of Hollywood and the little mess they've created out there, and that is extended just about everywhere. Oh, my gosh. I mean, yeah. I mean, who's entitled to do what?
These bodies do not belong to you.
Yep. There's... That is so powerful. I'm now looking at all kinds of surprising things you learned. Is it really true the largest breasts in the world are where?
The largest
where are they located?
The largest breasts in the world? I don't know. Did I? I don't think I wrote about where the largest breasts are.
They're in England?
Oh, well, the largest human-made breasts in the world are in England.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly. Where our little pal Desmond's hanging out with his sculptures and all the rest of it.
Yeah, there's a giant landscape sculpture in northern England. It's called the Lady of Northumberlandia, and it's basically this reclining naked woman. And people have moved bulldozers around to try to create these man-made breasts on this landscape. They took mine tailings and they turned them into breasts. And I hiked on these breasts. I climbed them. They're
you
covered in clover, and there's a nipple on top of each breast.
Oh my gosh! I just send me pictures. I the visual alone is starting to make me wonder about life in general. Oh my gosh!
You've got
What were some other surprising? Well, what were some other surprising things you learned?
Well, I was really interested. In fact, I thought I would just write one chapter on lactation, and I ended up writing three. And that's because what I learned about how lactation evolved and actually what's in our breast milk completely blew me away. I, like a lot of people, assumed that breast milk evolved and exists as a food source, you know, that infants drink breast milk in order to get food. But in fact, breast milk evolved as an immune support, and that's the first reason it came along. It conferred all these immune advantages to the infant. And in fact, that's still true today, and it's something that really cannot be replicated in formula. I mean, formula has done a really good job of replacing the fats and the sugars
right.
and the carbohydrates, but the more subtle immune components of breast milk have not yet been replicated. And in fact, the breast is almost like a smartphone in terms of being able to converse with the infant. So if you have an infant who has an infection, your breast actually senses that while the baby's at the breast, and it creates antibodies specific to that disease that the infant has. So there's this conversation constantly going on between the breast and the infant, and I was blown away to learn about that.
I think that's fascinating, but it makes all the sense in the world. I don't see us really putting together some kind of an optimized breast milk artificially, because how can you possibly duplicate all of those immune factors in a woman's body? And one woman's different than the next. You just can't.
And
I think that there's some, I think there's a connection there, a very powerful one between, mother and infant with regard to that communication, that interconnection on immune function alone. And that's not something that can be cookie cutter. I just don't see it that way at all. I see it as uniquely individual to that mom and child. I think that's a very, very powerful thing. So going on to yet another piece of one of your very powerful podcasts, why are breasts so sensitive to illness like cancer?
Yeah, it turns out, breast cancer is, it's still a very fast-growing cancer. It's almost doubled in incidence since the 1940s. I think it's the number one or two top cancer killer for especially middle-aged women in the United States. One out of eight women will get breast cancer. So we have to take it seriously. And one of the reasons, there are a couple of reasons, actually, why breasts appear to be so sensitive to cancer. One is that our breasts are filled with hormone receptors. This is because our breasts are constantly changing. Even over the course of every month, our breasts are sort of growing and disbanding in terms of, the mammary gland itself starting to build during our cycle. These estrogen receptors especially seem to be very vulnerable to artificial estrogens in our environment.
Uh-huh.
So there are many, for example, plastics and pesticides and a number of other chemicals that seem to mimic the estrogen chemical itself. And so our breasts are kind of absorbing some of these compounds. They're landing on our estrogen receptors, and they're actually changing the way our breasts grow and develop. And that's they're especially sensitive times in our breast development. So when we're in our mother's womb, for example, when our mammary gland is still developing, that's also a very, very sensitive time for chemicals to alter the development of the gland in a way that makes us more susceptible to breast cancer later on. And then we also know that our breasts are very fatty. Our breasts are very fatty as well. And because of that, they also absorb other toxic chemicals. So our breasts seem to be just uniquely sensitive.
Okay. And, you know, the other thing that you had mentioned in a very unique podcast is what men can teach us about breast cancer. This is really quite fascinating because when I first started at the National Institutes of Health a while back, this is just as Bernadine Healy came on as the first woman to direct the National Institutes of Health, she noticed that women actually weren't being studied in large enough numbers for breast cancer per se, but men were, which made absolutely no sense. So then she laid down a dictum and said, we need to study both, clearly, but really now prioritize bringing women on board in much larger numbers, multiple ages, and really wrap our heads around what is, you know, basically causation, genetics, et cetera. But with men, I remember having met a number of men who did have breast cancer. We were studying at the time. It's quite rare in men, needless to say, but there's something there to be learned. So tell us what you found in the podcast.
Yeah, you're correct. It's quite rare in men. Men seem to get it at about 1% of the rate that women get it. However, I found out about a male breast cancer cluster in North Carolina centered around a military base, a Marine base, Camp Lejeune. We know that the groundwater in this Marine base is the most polluted groundwater ever found in a public water supply. And there are about 80 men who have come forward who either were born on this base or lived on this base or served on this base sometime over the last about 40 years. So I found out about this cluster, and there's one man in particular, Michael Partain, who became an activist. He went online and he said, look, I have breast cancer. If you have breast cancer, get in touch with me. And so single-handedly, he really discovered this cluster, and he started asking a lot of questions. And so I went down there and I met with him, and I met with some of the researchers at NIEHS, part of the NIH, as you mentioned. And they do have a lot to teach us when they cluster around. Because it's such a rare disease and a cluster emerges, it becomes a real opportunity. We can look at this population and see if they were exposed to something unusual and possibly draw a clearer line between an environmental or chemical exposure and the actual outcome, the sad outcome of breast cancer. When women get breast cancer, it's much more diffuse. It's much harder to sort of pinpoint a particular reason. You know, we know that there are so many reasons why a woman may get breast cancer. You know, everything from how long she lactated to the age of her first period and how much estrogen she's had in her body, you know, whether she took hormone replacement therapy. Now birth control pills also have a slightly elevated risk of breast cancer. But when a man gets breast cancer, you know, a man, he doesn't have those risk factors, right? So there's something else going on, and we have an opportunity to learn something. So what we found out is that there are a number of industrial solvents that were in this water supply, including tetrachloroethylene and trichloroethylene, as well as some pesticides and polyvinyl chloride. And so now researchers have something to look at. And in fact, they are studying what happens when you take those chemicals and you expose a mother to those chemicals, what happens to her pups if you're looking at a mouse model? And are her pups actually more likely to develop mammary gland tumors? And it turns out that the answer looks like yes, that is in fact what's happening. And it looks like on an epidemiological level, that's what's happening too. And now government studies have shown that yes, people who lived on this base do do, in fact, have an elevated risk of breast cancer. And that's true of both men and women, but it's because of the men and their cluster that we really have been able to see this link.
So well, you know, the combinations of the, you know, of the milieu of these terrible chemicals, you know, clearly sounds like you had hormone disruptors. You had, very potent combinations of toxins that increased the epigenetic, and that means, you know, the expression of the genes, negative potential for cancer, basically upregulated that. And it's when you have these unique and very rare type of episodes like what happened with the waters in North Carolina, that you can really parse out some real nuggets of research gold there to be able to help us give us direction. So that's fantastic. I mean, again, everyone out there, you just have to listen to the Apple podcast on this because it's really, really fascinating. You know, fewer and fewer people out there are breastfeeding. What does this mean with regard to our wonderful breasts and everything else?
Well, I believe it's a sign that, you know, we are not really taking breasts very seriously in terms of what they have evolved to do. I mean, I feel like they are these incredible, miraculous organs, right? And they increase our immune system. They can help set up our gut microflora for life. You know, there are all these amazing bacteria in breast milk. Breast milk is a living substance. Like yogurt, you know, it has these live microbes in it that actually set up the infant gut for life. And so it tells me that we're not taking them seriously enough for those kind of miraculous qualities, that we have tended to over-sexualize breasts. And it also tells me that we don't have enough social support for breastfeeding. So in the United States, for example, you know, women get 6 weeks of maternity leave, if any. They don't get a lot of support at work. There are sometimes really inadequate pumping stations, for example. And I think in some cultures, too, there's just this discomfort, you know, with the idea of breastfeeding. For example, we give women a lot of grief for breastfeeding in public. Sometimes women are still getting arrested for breastfeeding in public. And yet, you know, we have, you know, breasts everywhere in advertising. We have them everywhere on the internet, everywhere in Hollywood. But, oh, once you put a baby on the breast, no, we don't want to see that. And so I think we have a real problem with how we view breasts and what it means for our health.
And it gives us a moment to hit the pause button here, you know, in our culture and say, what does this really mean about us and our belief systems and our perceptions here? And this, what you've done with your work here, it's really laid down a powerful foundation for us to re-examine, reassess, and maybe completely redefine how we're really perceiving breasts, both in terms of their health and medical, as well as all of this sexualizing and back and forth. You know, as we close up the podcast, I'd love to hear from you, and I know all of our listeners in her podcast land would like to hear what are the most important lessons we can give people, especially young people, about breasts and their bodies.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, because I am particularly interested in young people and the kind of messages we give them, and how those messages can really determine a lifetime of kind of healthy emotional outcomes and also healthy physical outcomes. You know, so many kids learn about their bodies and learn about sexuality from the internet and from pornography. And girls grow up believing that their breasts are supposed to look a certain way. Boys grow up expecting breasts to look a certain way. And I think that does such a disservice to everybody, because, in fact, breasts are beautiful and they work so beautifully. And I think we have to learn how to celebrate normalcy, right, and how to celebrate all kinds of different breasts. And when we do that, we can really provide a healthy model so that we can help women grow into themselves, love their bodies, embrace their bodies, embrace their sexuality, but also take breasts seriously for how they work and what they do. And I think that would do a great service, not only to the women, but to their babies as well.
Oh, man, this is excellent. Everyone out there, we've been listening to Florence Williams. She's got a couple phenomenal books. We've really been talking about her first book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, which was a New York Times notable book of 2012. And she has a fantastic 8-series Apple podcast on the breasts. And I went through what the 8 podcast segments were, and I'm telling you right now, this is the A to Z on everything you ever want to know about breasts. Thank you so much, Florence, for being on the Her podcast, because this has just been terrific. And to learn more about Florence's wonderful work, please go to florencewilliams.com, and as well, go to itunes.apple.com /us/podcast/breasts unbound, and you're going to be able to find her Apple podcast. Florence, thanks so much for being on the Her podcast.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pam. It's been a pleasure.
All right. And everyone out there, remember to catch every episode of Her by just hitting subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com. And just take a moment now and rate and review this really extraordinary podcast. Boy, I bet you've been taking notes right and left. Just do that on iTunes, because I'm sitting here waiting to hear from you. I'm Dr. Pam Peek. Follow me on Twitter at PamPeakMD, and you can also check out our Her Show page at RadioMD.com for all of our past episodes. Thanks for listening, and stay well.